And we're back at Club 30, presented by Verizon. I'm Henrik Lundqvist, your host. I'm sitting here with my good friend Jay.
Hey guys, welcome back. Another great episode today.
You know what? Growing up in a ski town in Sweden in the 80s, you know, I watched Ingmar Stenmark competing. Today's guest, one of the best female skier of all time. Lindsey Vonn.
I was in the stretcher asking, how long is it going to take? Is it 6 months? Is this 6 weeks? You know, what do I got? And the second I was given a definitive answer, okay, you blew your knee out, you blew your MCL, you've got fractures, it's going to be 8 to 10 months. I'm like, okay, so 6 months, I'm going to be back, you know, and I looked at it as a next goal. How do I get back? This is my plan. This is now my new plan, my only plan. And I just slowly grind and grind and grind and get myself back.
I love how transparent and open she was about her battles with mental health and dealing with injury and coming back. And mostly I just love that she's an adrenaline junkie and a psychopath. And she is wired way differently. And I love that.
And that's why she was one of the best ever to do it.
Yeah.
So, everyone, here's Lindsey Vonn. She's a legend on the slopes, a three-time Olympic medalist, a four-time World Cup overall champion, and probably the fastest person we ever had on the show.
Yeah.
We need a woman's perspective
the first
on things.
One.
Yeah, the first one to ski the strife and the first woman on Club 30. Thank you.
Perfect.
Yeah, they're equivalent.
Pretty similar.
Yeah.
I grew up in a small town in Sweden called Åre.
May or may not know of that place.
And in Swedish, we call it Åre.
Åre.
But I know this is a special place for you because it's where you won your first and last world championship medal and also the last place you raced before you retired.
Yeah.
What do you remember about that last race?
It was crazy. I love Åre. And I'm from Minnesota, which is also a very similar, like, geographical location from, like, how everything looks, the landscape and architecture, because I'm Norwegian of heritage. And the last race in Sweden was, I would say, almost as nerve-wracking as the Olympics, because it was my last race. And I didn't want people to remember me, you know, if I didn't do well. Like, if I crash, I didn't want that to be kind of my legacy, my last note. And there was no option for me to do more races because my body was literally disintegrating before my eyes. And so, you know, there was no option for me but to figure out a way how to get on the podium. And all the pieces thankfully came together and I was able to pull it off. But that was probably the most challenging physically of a race I've ever had, just because I was so beat up at that point. I was racing with two knee braces. I had three fractures in my right leg. I had no LCL on my left leg. I had crashed in the Super G 2 days earlier. I had a black eye. I was like, this has got to stop.
Jeez.
You know, I was like, this is, you know, my body, everything's saying, please stop. So I did.
And I remember watching the interview afterwards. Swedish legend Ingmar Stenmark was there. What did he mean to you? It felt like it was important for you to have him there.
Yeah. And he's the best. I mean, he's honestly such a legend in our sport. And it was really meaningful for me to have him there. He'd been planning on coming a couple days later, but I texted him. I was like, listen, Ingmar, can you please come? This is my last race. It would really mean the world to me. And he came and, you know, he was waiting for me in the finish. And it was like, it was such a, you know, an emotional moment to have him there, my family, you know, my teammates, and, you know, those kinds of moments you hold on to forever. And he was just kind of the icing on the cake. And from a, you know, historical and emotional perspective, it was so meaningful.
I just want to let our listeners know about Ingmar Stenmark. As a Swede, growing up in Sweden, this is how big this guy was, all right? I was in probably first, second grade, middle class, and the teacher will stop whatever we was doing, and they were rolling the TV, and the class were watching Ingmar race.
Yeah.
Sweden stopped when this guy was racing.
Yeah.
This is how big he was, and such a nice person as well.
He's a god in Sweden, and I have so many people telling me that exact same story from all different parts of Sweden. It's so amazing how big of an impact he had, and he still has on the sport. It's It's so impressive. He won so many races in such a short period of time. It was incredible.
Looking at your career, like, what made you such a unique skier? I mean, the fact that you look at all the accomplishments, you won so many things. What? Why?
I think I was just different. I was really authentically me, and I'm a downhiller, so I'm inherently a risk taker, and I'm very much not afraid to speak my mind. And I think people remember me or know me for my fearlessness, and that I was willing to do whatever it took to win races and throw myself down the mountain at any cost, which, you know, most of the time cost me quite a bit with all of my injuries, but I always found a way to pick myself back up and keep going. And it wasn't the success that drove me. It was the love for my sport. And I think people understood that about me, and or at least I hope they did. But I love going fast. You know, I love that speed adrenaline demon. I love it. Yeah, there's nothing like it. And I think that's the hardest thing for me now in retirement, is that there truly is nothing that's even remotely similar to downhill skiing.
And are you going skydiving and stuff now?
I've saved that as like an emergency. That's like an emergency backup. If I really get in the need of adrenaline, I'm just like, okay, I can finally go skydiving.
Yeah. And also, I've been thinking about this. Equipment, obviously, it's a big part of sports and hockey and skiing. And yeah, throughout your career, the equipment changed a lot.
A lot.
Did that affect how you were skiing, or did you make sure the equipment adjusted to you?
I mean, that's kind of cat and mouse, because, you know, the skis definitely changed over time, and there's certain rules and regulations to that change that I had no control over. But to the degree that I could adjust the setup that was there, I did. I was very finicky and detail-oriented, and I had notebooks about every single thing I changed and all my skis. And when you go out and you train, you don't just train for technique. You also mainly train for equipment. So,
right,
you know, if you take seven runs, you have seven different pair of skis with seven different setups, and you have to be able to feel the difference and adjust it. And that's how everything in the off season goes. So equipment was a huge part of
what did they regulate in the World Cup? Length, side cut?
Everything, yeah. From the internal boot height to the binding height to the radius to the length. It really is everything. It's a little over the top, if I do say so myself, but, you know, they're also trying to limit the risk factor in trying to slow us down. So when they had really large parabolic skis, you know, with a lot of radius, which was easy to turn.
Sure.
There's a lot of injuries. People are going so fast, so they decided to take that back. And it's kind of similar in the sense of, you know, tennis, like going from the wooden racket and how that's evolved. It is very similar in skiing. It really changed the sport. So it's a lot different from when Ingemar was racing. You know, he was skiing on pretty much the same length of skis that I'm on for downhill, but in slalom, which, you know, ski racing, you know, that's crazy.
But it is the same. Like in hockey, the top players, they're kind of part of developing the new product, same in skiing. So you're kind of pushing that development with the manufacturers and have the testing and feedbacks and all that.
I mean, I'm very detail oriented, so I can feel things really quickly. Unfortunately, a lot of the time, because I was a woman, they didn't really believe what I had to say. And then it was only until a man said the same thing that they actually believed that was the case, which I found very frustrating in my career. I think towards the end, they definitely realized after repeated instances that I may or may not be able to feel something and have an idea of what I'm doing. But yeah, that was one of the frustrating parts, is that they generally tended to make equipment based on what the men said and not what the women said. But when I switched over to men's skis, it really helped a lot, because it worked out that what I liked is very similar to what all the men liked. And so it was less of a conversation with the development.
So what is the difference between a woman's and men's? Is it just the flex?
Everything.
Everything.
Yeah. Length, flex, basically a much heavier, sturdier, harder to turn ski. And you can go a lot faster if you're able to maneuver the ski. But I think a lot of women didn't ever try it because they were always told they couldn't. And they assumed that they couldn't. And I was like, oh, there's no reason why I can't. So let's try it. And I did. And everyone laughed at me at first. And then I beat everyone. And then everyone else was on the same ski.
I love that. You know what? I just picked up skiing after 20 years of absence because of hockey.
But you're a hockey player, so you must have really good skills on skis,
well,
I would imagine.
I grew up
and you grew up in Sweden.
I grew up in RA, so I grew up skiing. I grew up competing, and then it stopped, and hockey was the only thing I focused on pretty much. But I just love now being able to be on a mountain and the speed, the air, everything. It just gives me so much positive energy.
Yeah.
What does skiing mean to you?
Well, first of all, I would love to ski with you. So
let's do it.
I think we should do that. Yeah, I think we should invite Roger.
Let's do
since
it.
Since he's getting back on skis too. All
about
us
Roger
retired
Federer.
Folks.
I saw him was on skis also this past winter.
I know. I think skiing for me is different now. You know, it's I found kind of the joy that I originally found when I was a kid. And that's what I love doing, just being out there and being with my friends and family. I have to remember that I'm not going to get the same adrenaline rush that I used to, but I'm kind of adapting my mindset. And, you know, I feel like I'm a kid again. You know, I'm out there on the mountain just having fun and enjoying it. And I do think skiing is one of the few sports where you get that sense of freedom and, you know, like that positive energy, and you're just outside, no phones, you know, no distractions. You're just enjoying time with your friends and family. And I think it's very special in that way.
Yeah. I think it's a sport that can be everything to everyone.
Yeah.
Where like Hank doesn't think about like, what's my ideal day? He's like, oh, I'm going to go to the hockey rink and skate.
Yeah.
That's
not happening.
It's not happening. You might go skate with the girls or.
Yeah. How many times do you actually skate? I want to know.
Since I retired?
Yeah.
I think two times with my kids,
okay.
But
that's
to
a good
put
reason.
The equipment back on and do like a full hockey practice, it will probably never happen.
I don't
again.
See you right. in sort of. I don't see you doing a beer league.
Right. No,
no,
it will not happen.
No.
No, but you know when you've been doing it for so long in a certain way, very competitive, it's hard for me to. Yeah, let's go to the rink and play hockey.
I know.
I just, but I could see the difference though, if
with
it was
kids.
Skiing. But no, I was going to say if it was skiing, like. The fact that you're outdoors on the mountain and I also want to know with that, now when you're not competing, do you go off piste more? Do you go on these crazy skiing trips, heli skiing? Or was that, I'm sure maybe during your career, you didn't want
to
risk anything.
I never did that. Yeah. No. When I was racing, I never did that. And you know, it's like you are always so focused on staying healthy for what you were supposed to be doing that I couldn't even think of doing something risky like that. But yeah, I actually did one heli trip in Iceland, which was crazy. I was skiing at like 1 a.m. The sun never set. It was like the longest day of the year and it was insanely stunning. I think one of those once in a lifetime trips. But I really like skiing in the trees because there's actually a little bit of risk there and I, you know, I'm like bobbing and weaving in between
the trees.
Yeah. You know, just add a little bit more risk and it makes me a little bit more excited. So
you're a little adrenaline junkie a little bit.
I'll seek it out if I can.
So where's your favorite place to ski?
I mean, are we talking about skiing? Are we talking about après ski?
You know, I think you should include everything.
Yeah. So like the system balance.
Okay. I'd say if I'm talking about the overall picture, including après ski, which is important to me at this point.
Yes.
I think probably Val d'Isère because it's got great skiing. You obviously can ski all the way over to Tiene. There's this amazing restaurant like at the top of the tram in Tiene. It's like a Michelin star in the middle of nowhere. And then, you know, it's got really cute bars and après skiing is great. And I think if you go to Courchevel, you can obviously then go to like Mirabel and go to Folie Douce and, you know, us Europeans, the Europeans that I'm talking about, but, you know,
I'm
it's
Canadian,
like clubbing
so
on
no
that.
Idea.
Yeah, you Canadians are way too conservative for that. But, I think Val d'Isère kind of has a really good mix of everything and the hotels are really cute. They're not overly expensive or overly commercialized. It's kind of still has that quaintness, but it's got great skiing. So that's kind of, and I race there many times. So I know, you know, a lot of the hotel owners and I'm kind of friends with people there and. There's like a golden retriever that rides the bus all the time that I'm friends with.
Sold.
Well, before you came on the show here the last couple of days, me and Jay, we were watching this crazy race you did.
Which one?
The Red Bull film.
Oh, the Strife.
That was definitely.
Yeah, you had a lot of crazy races.
Well, that's
but we were talking
crazy.
About Strife.
Yeah.
So when I ski, I complain about when it goes from sunny to cloudy, it's hard to see. You did it at night. And I saw some parts were pretty dark. Like, how do you handle that at that speed?
Well, have you ever skied at night? Like in Åre, they had night skiing.
Yeah, we had night skiing. Yeah.
It's, I mean, in some ways, you can see a little bit more just because of the depth. But in some ways, it's obviously very dark, so it's hard to see. I think for me, I actually have pretty bad eyesight. We did a whole test with the whole U.S. ski team, men and women, and I had the worst eyesight of every single person. So I think I rely more on my feel than I do necessarily my sight. And, you know, I think to some degree, you know, when you're going that fast, you kind of just have to go, and you know where you're going, but you don't necessarily all the time see exactly what's coming. And I think that's where the feel comes in. So I think that whole, you know, skiing the Strive at night was an amazing opportunity. And growing up in Minnesota, I skied at night every single day. So I was kind of used to it. But I mean, I haven't skied a downhill since my last race in Sweden. And I was in the starting gate, like, what the hell am I doing here right now?
So you're the first, by the way, the first human to do it at night, right?
Yeah.
Strive?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Is there a certain element where the less visual stimulation, the better, because you can focus in on the gates, or is
I
it?
I think to a degree, I think, you know, when you're racing and there's a lot of people on the sidelines, which not every race has that, but I think that can be distracting sometimes. But I think also when you start going, you're going so fast, you can't really see anything but the gates in front of you. So I don't know. I think it was in a sense tunnel vision, because that's all you could see. But
right.
So is it kind of like, you know, you have race car drivers, they know every turn. Is that kind of the same thing for you when you've been going through it in your head every turn the whole way down?
That's, I think, what was one of my strong suits, is that I visualize the course, I mean, a couple hundred times before I ran it. So there wasn't any question of where I'm going or what I'm doing or what the game plan is. If I make a mistake, I know exactly where I can make up the time, where I can't. I have kind of a game plan for every scenario. And obviously you have to, there's always things you don't predict that could happen, but that gave me a lot of peace of mind and confidence when I was in the starting gate, because you have to be able to go, and you have to have the course automatized in your mind so that you're focused on what your body is doing, not worried about where the gates are or where you're supposed to go or where the jump is, so you don't accidentally fly off.
Yeah, you know, that's not dissimilar to your prep, right?
Well, I do a lot. I did go through my head a lot, like how I need to play my game, what I need to do to have success. But you kind of knew what to expect, right?
It's different.
I could never dictate.
Sure.
Or I always had to react what was happening in front of me. Well, when you're skiing, you can plan the race, right?
Yeah.
And really determine exactly how to do every turn. So I would say that was the big difference. But especially for a goalie, if you're a forward, you can dictate the play. You can decide what to do and where you want to go with the puck. But as a goalie, I'm just waiting for whatever that guy is doing. And I have to react to whatever he is doing. So I guess the key there is just to be so in the moment and kind of read the play.
How much reaction training did you do? You must have done a ton.
Not a ton.
Really?
I guess the reaction training was really just facing a lot of shots.
Yeah.
Take a lot of shots. And obviously, my game changed so much over time as well because of technique, because of equipment, and just the way you moved out there changed a lot. So you had to adjust. But back, we talked about it earlier, when you reach a certain level, you become part of that progress, right? You become part of, you know, working with the people that develop equipment, so you can give them some feedback. This would really help my game.
Yeah.
Can we make that equipment? And that's kind of cool when you reach that level where you have an impact on that, and you can feel like it's benefiting your own game.
Yeah, 100%.
But I want to talk about, like, I look at your career, and it's so impressive with all the medals and world championship, Olympics. But the most impressive thing to me is your ability to come back from injuries. You had some serious injuries, and let's talk about that a little bit. Your mindset coming back from these injuries, where was your head at? And also, was it scary to be back in the slopes after, you know, were you scared of falling, for example?
I was never afraid of falling again. I think, you know, for me, I approached all of my injuries the same way. I was in the stretcher asking, how long is it going to take? Like, is this 6 months? Is this 6 weeks? You know, what do I got? And the second I was given a definitive answer, okay, you blew your knee out, you blew your MCL, you've got fractures, it's going to be 8 to 10 months. I'm like, okay, so 6 months, I'm going to be back, you know, and I looked at it as a next goal. I kind of erased what I had planned on doing. And then I fixated on that as my goal. How do I get back? This is my plan. This is now my new plan, my only plan. And I just slowly grind and grind and grind and get myself back to hopefully where I was before. I mean, I was always, unfortunately, a little bit less than physically because, you know, you're never the same once you've had a big surgery. But I then became smarter. You know, I learned how to be a lot more tactical. Even though I was fairly tactical beforehand, I really had to minimize the risk. You know, I never was worried when I was in the starting gate of if I would crash. I knew I would. There's never an option of like, you're not going to crash ever. You're always going to crash.
Yeah.
So like you just eliminate that from your mindset. You know, it's like, I need to risk everything if I want to win. I know I've put in the work. I'm strong enough. And this is what I have to do. And, you know, I would obviously fall again, but I would do the same process and pick myself back up. And I think I looked at it as an opportunity. I had to. You know, if you sit there and dwell and say, oh, woe is me, this shouldn't have happened. You know, some of the things that happened to me were really unfortunate because it was mainly snow conditions and some unsafe, you know, racing conditions that we should never have done. But if I sit there and think about that, you're never going to go anywhere. So I just had to focus on what can I control? How can I get back there? And, you know, my mom also had a stroke when she gave birth to me. And so she had a lot of disabilities because of that. And she never complained. And she always had this amazing positive outlook. And I always thought to myself, well, if my mom can have that positive outlook and she will never be better, why shouldn't I have that outlook and I can be better? So I think it's that mindset. I think if you fixate on the wrong things, it's really easy to go down the slope of getting in a dark hole and not being able to climb out. But I think all those things kind of helped me get through it.
What injury was the toughest for you to come back from, both mentally and physically?
I mean, the hardest overall, I think, was my second ACL. It was a second ACL in a 10-month span. I was really trying hard to come back for the Sochi Olympics. And I was watching the Olympics on TV, and I was just really depressed. You know, it was a hard time. And I adopted a dog. I was like, I can't do this alone. You know, I need someone. And it was good for me because there was a time when I just was like, why am I doing this? I keep getting hurt. Am I making any progress? And my physical therapist was a good friend of mine, Lindsay Winninger, and she would literally like rip the covers off me and pull me out of bed and get me going because for a while it was really hard. But once I kind of got past the hump of like, it was like a month or 2 months, where I felt like I was actually making progress, then I got better. But I think just having that many major surgeries in a short period of time and being away from what you love for so long was really hard for me.
It was challenging mentally.
Yeah, it was it's no bueno.
And you talked about this publicly about, you know, the challenge for not only for you, but for athletes with the mental aspect of it and how to stay positive. And I wonder, you know, people might look at athletes and say, yeah, they have it all. They're, you know, they're living their dream. But it is really a struggle for many people to stay, especially when you reach the top, to stay up there, the pressure and the injuries. And why do you think it's so hard mentally to be positive all the time?
It's a lot of sacrifice. I think, you know, when you get to the top and staying at the top, it is one of the loneliest places on the earth. You're surrounded by people and yet you're completely isolated. It's very different what you see on the outside to what it is on the inside. And that's our goal, right? We want to win. We want to be successful. But once you get there and to stay there, that grind that it takes, you have to really love what you do to be able to sacrifice and put that much grit and effort into it every single day, because you cannot let up. You don't have an off day. If you have an off day, someone else is going to take your spot. So you really have to love what you do. And I think because everyone's talked about mental health so much in the last couple of years, Simone and Michael Phelps and Kevin Love and all those people, I think you realize that this shiny figure that we have that we think, you know, is the epitome of a superhero is not really a superhero. And we should always aspire to be that great person, but it is not perfection. No one's perfect. Nothing is easy. And I think, you know, we have more empathy because of these conversations to understand really what it takes to be a champion.
You mentioned your friend kind of pulling you out of, you know, the covers off and dragging you out of bed. Like, how did you build your own personal success? If you're, it sounds like you're in a darker place.
Yeah, I mean, I had a really great support system around me. You know, my sister was always there. My brother, great at making tomato soup and grilled cheese sandwiches.
Simple stuff.
Bringing me my Ben and Jerry's when I really needed it.
Yeah.
And, you know, just it's like literally step by step and day by day. And if you look at the big picture, sometimes when you're injured, it's so overwhelming because you feel like you have so far to go.
Yeah.
I mean, I literally had to relearn how to walk. And again, it just seems so far off. Like, how do I go from walking again to racing again? And it just seems like this insurmountable thing that I can never, you know, I can't get there. But if you have people around you that can kind of help you see the day-to-day stuff and the simple things and just keep it really straightforward, like, you know, it doesn't take much, but it takes a support system. And I think one thing that's really difficult for athletes is that, especially with team sports, is that when you're injured, you're gone. Like, bye-bye.
I know.
No one cares about you. No one calls you. They have a million people that can replace you in any second. And you're really forgotten about until you figure out how to get yourself back onto the playing field and figure out how to win again. And I think that's a really lonely place to be. And I think there needs to be more support around those athletes because it is kind of, you're on your own.
Yeah, luckily, throughout my career, I didn't have that many injuries. I had one serious neck injury where I was out about 2 months. And just to feel like you're on the sideline, I remember that feeling. All you want, you just want to get back in there, be part of it, and try to make a difference, right? And it's a big part of sports, professional sports. You're going to deal with injuries. And I'm listening to you, Lindsay, and I'm just so impressed how you managed to overcome it. But to me, it comes down to one thing. It's the love for what you do.
Yeah.
If you don't have that passion and the love for what you do, it's going to be extremely hard to deal with that.
Yeah.
And we talked about it the other day on the show that you need passion for what you do because that's going to help you overcome all these challenges.
But yeah.
I just have to say, the way you handle it and come back, and that's impressive. It really is, and inspiring.
Yeah.
Because when you've been there yourself, I think it's very important to have a good, you know, support system around you, right? And
yeah.
We have a team, and for you, it sounded like you had good people around you helping as well.
Yeah, I think I had a really great team around me and, you know, my family and everyone. I think physically that side was taken care of. I think mental health-wise, I never really shared kind of what I was going through because of just the way I thought of myself, that I couldn't show any signs of weakness. And I did have maybe two people that kind of knew what I was going through. My physical therapist was one of them. And otherwise, I didn't really share much because I think if I admitted to myself what I was going through, then it was like admitting weakness. And I didn't, you know, I just didn't want to do that. So I found ways to deal with, you know, depression and anxiety and the pressure of everything. And I was able to kind of bottle things up and use them when I needed to. Like, I used a lot of the emotion that I felt, and I was able to kind of channel that into my skiing. And skiing was my passion, but it was also my outlet. It was kind of like a crutch, like an emotional crutch for me. And so that was another thing that I had to figure out when I retired, is like, what's my crutch? I don't have any other outlet. I'm stuck with my own emotions. I can't get them out. There's nothing. There's nowhere for them to go. And so that hard for me to figure out. It's not like there's, you know, sports psychologists like there are now. And, you know, back when I was racing, I started dealing with depression. I was 18 years old, and there was certainly no one around at that time that was going to talk to me about that. You know, and I'm also like trying to find my spot on the team, and you're not going to show weakness or perceived weakness, you know, at that stage of your career. So again, I kind of found a way through it. And in the end, I really loved the pressure because that was the best outlet for me. You know, the more pressure, the more I could get out, and I enjoyed it.
And it's such a fine line too, being a professional athlete. You're talking about not showing anything. I mean, a lot of to perform, you kind of tell yourself, you got to find a way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you might feel a little off, you might feel a little down, you're a little hurt. It's always about finding a way. So you don't want to also open the door too much. Like, how do I really feel today?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, what? I don't feel great. I can't play or I can't race.
Yeah.
So you teach your system to kind of block everything. Yeah. Okay, I got to find a way here to get it done.
Sure. Yeah.
Until you can't, and you kind of have to open that door. Like, listen, I need to work on this now because I can't block that anymore. I think that happens a lot for a lot of people where you just teach yourself to like,
Shut it off. At some point, the faucet is going to open.
Yeah,
right. You'll deal with it.
Well, I think that's all like well and good while you're a pro athlete, but like, what happens
as
after?
As a normal person, it's horrible.
Right. Like, where do you bottle it up?
Yeah, it's really hard. As I said, you know, it's like, this is great for skiing and as an athlete, you need to be able to do this. But then as a normal person, that doesn't work. That is not a way to deal with your emotions at all. And so I had to figure, I was basically like, I was a teenager starting from scratch. You know, how do I deal with my emotions? How do I, you know, I can't just be this persona. I am me and I have these emotions and I have to deal with them. So it was an interesting process. And
any tips?
Dr. Armando Gonzalez is amazing.
Okay.
He works with a lot of athletes. He's really changed my life because it's kind of a different way of approaching everything and just kind of sitting with your emotions and like processing them and thinking about it instead of just talking about it and like trying to pretend that it doesn't exist and put it in some weird box somewhere. It's like, no, sit with your emotions, think about it, feel it, and get through it yourself.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that was just a really different way of thinking about it and processing it. And, you know, I don't know. Because there's no more skiing there. There was no other option, so I had to figure it out. And I kind of related actually to boxing. It's like the ones that are really successful, they have so much inside of them and they're just kind of waiting to let it out. And that's so much how I was in skiing.
Yeah. I think feel like it's a battle that you don't really think you're in until you don't have that one singular focus. And the battle afterwards is to stay present.
Yeah.
Right. To be like, oh, there is actually no past. There's no future. Like, how do I stay present when I don't have this one singular focus? Like, how do you, you know, you've been retired now 2 years. How do you stay in the moment every day?
Well, I shifted so much from it was all about performance to try to be happy. During my career, my goal is not to. Don't get me wrong. I enjoyed my time. I had the best time. I had so much fun. No, it's about performance and try to win. Let's be honest. You know, that's what you're pushing yourself for. You want to get better as an athlete and achieve. And then you stop playing and you're like, okay, what's my goal here?
Yeah.
For me, it was a couple moments that kind of clarified that and helped me. But I want to ask you, Lindsay, is this something you're going to continue? You're talking to someone now in your life, like a life coach or?
It's Dr. Gonzalez, Dr. Armando Gonzalez. I call him Mondo. He kind of gave me a toolbox where if I know how to figure it out on my own. He's kind of given me the tools to be able to, you know, process and handle whatever it is. I mean, it's been the last year has been probably one of the most challenging years of my life. I lost my mother, my grandmother, and my dog.
I'm sorry.
And taught me all the skills I needed to get through it. And I still had to lean on him, but I don't think I would have been able to get through that without him, and especially being retired. And if I had been in the same position before without the skills, I would be not functioning. But I feel good, and, you know, I kind of, again, put things into perspective, and I think also my mom just made me appreciate every day, every opportunity. There's so much to be happy about and proud of, and every day is another opportunity, and so I really take that seriously, and I've always had that approach because of her, but especially now, and just life is really short, so find ways to be happy and find ways to enjoy it and to be around people that you care about and love, and just don't take anything for granted.
I mean, that's a great point. And so what is important to you today in terms of how you spend your time? I know you've done some documentaries, you've written books. Is that where your focus is at right now?
A lot of people say, oh, you're too busy, you do too much. And I what I talked about and learned with Dr. Mondo is that that's where I thrive. I thrive working hard. I thrive with a lot going on, and it's not a bad thing to be ambitious. And a lot of people say, like, oh, you're too ambitious, you're too strong. I'm like, I can be, you know, a woman and be strong and, like, do a lot in my life, and there's nothing wrong with that. So I think I've just leaned into that, and there's obviously a lot going on with my business that's gone very well, but mainly I think my foundation, our mission is to inspire and empower underserved girls with programs and scholarships. And it's just been very rewarding. It's amazing to be in the position where, you know, people look up to you and you can impact them in a positive way. And I was inspired to be an Olympian by my idol, Peekaboo Street, when I was 9 years old. I waited a couple hours for her at an autograph signing in Minnesota. And meeting her for 90 seconds is the reason why I became an Olympian. And so I try to give that back, you know, in whatever way I can, to just show kids that they can be whatever they set their mind to.
Amazing.
That's really cool. And that's, you did a documentary about Peekaboo.
Yeah, it was
your childhood idol.
Yes.
How cool was that experience?
It was so cool. I was so nervous. I don't normally get nervous for anything like that, but I mean, I was so nervous. I'm doing a documentary on my idol. It's like everything came so full circle, and to be able to help her share her story, because there was so much of her story that no one knew, including me as like the super fan who's read her book and like obviously shadowed her since I was a kid. But that was really special. And also working with Frank Marshall, who's an absolute legend, and co-directing and producing with him was amazing. So that was my first project, kind of with my production company, you know, major project. And it was very rewarding, and obviously professionally also incredibly rewarding.
Anki, you just got your first project off the ground, right?
Yeah. Ooh,
tell me.
Yeah.
Please tell.
Yeah, no, it's exciting. I've been working for the past year and a half on a documentary film about kind of the last couple of years of my life. You know, my time in New York ended. I had to have open heart surgery, a few setbacks with that. I retired from hockey. Just stuff that kind of life-changing in a way.
Yeah.
So it's a lot about mindset in this film, and we're premiering it at Tribeca Film Festival.
Ooh.
June 15th.
Wow. So, hey, all right.
If you're in town, you should come and check it out.
I would love to. I'm actually getting my knee replaced a couple days before that, so I don't know if I'll be able to make it.
You'll be on
crutches. But maybe you guys could send me like a sneak peek, and I'll give it some great reviews.
Yeah,
I'm very excited.
Thank you.
That's awesome.
No, it's a little nerve-wracking. It's a very open and honest film, but, you know, it was definitely 2 years of my life where I had to work a lot on myself and mindset and overcome a few things. And it really helped me in a big way. I was in such a good place throughout different challenges, and I'm a better person for it now. Like, and it really helped me guide me through my next chapter in life. So,
yeah, I think it's important to let everybody know that the standard isn't perfection.
There is no such thing as perfection.
Right.
The standard is being the best, your best self.
That's right. And the movement, you know, this kind of radically transparent movement towards like, hey, I have challenges. I struggle to get out of bed sometimes, or sometimes I'm not happy. Like, I think that's important for people to understand, is that everybody has those feelings, you know, and it could be Henrik Lundqvist, could be Lindsey Vonn. There's something that unites us as humans, is the struggle every day where we have to get up.
Yeah.
And we have to figure out, like, how do we deploy ourselves? How do we find gratitude? And so all of these conversations and all of the things that you're putting out in the world, I think, are really important for people.
I feel like there's still athletes, especially professional athletes, there's still, you know, that superhero that kids look up to. But I think it's important to know that superheroes are not perfect.
Yeah,
that's the difference.
Not.
It's like, we need someone to aspire to be. Everyone needs that hero. Everyone needs to have that vision of something better.
Sure.
Yeah.
But just knowing that that person is not perfect, I think also helps everyone else to understand, like, my imperfections are okay.
And I also think that, you know, everybody goes through something, right? It doesn't matter who you are. And I remember this so well, coming off of heart surgery. You know, I was staying in touch with a friend of mine and Jay, Chris Chupp, who was dealing with ALS.
That's what my mom died of.
Is it?
Oh, yeah, ALS is brutal.
Yeah, we lost Chris in November.
To just have perspective on your situation, that definitely helped me coming off of heart surgery and laying there and like, okay, I have a different plan here. And just perspective, I think that helped me.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, sorry too.
Life's a bitch.
ALS is the worst.
It literally is. I think the hardest thing for me is that I felt really ignorant because I did the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge and I had no idea what it was. And then when the doctors called and said, my mom has ALS, I'm like, okay, well, what does that mean? And they're like, it's a terminal disease. She's going to die. And I'm like, I did this ice bucket. I have no idea what it was. And then, you know, explaining to people, I'm like, you know, my mom has ALS. And they're like, okay, well, she'll be better soon. I'm like, no, that's not how it is. So I think that has been hard for me. And also, if you don't know what it is, you don't really... You can't really grasp the magnitude of it. Unfortunately, or fortunately, however you want to look at it, I think there is some fortune in that her struggle was short, because that can be so hard for everyone, for the person going through it, for the family. It is just day in and day out a debilitating disease and situation, and it can take so much out of everyone. So I'm just happy my mom's not in pain anymore, to be honest.
Yeah. So sorry.
Well, you guys know.
Yeah. Now, to your point, it affects everybody around, family, friends, and again, perspective of life. Let's make the most of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
That's what I try to do. My mom always said, today is another great day.
Great day to be great.
That's what I say every day. So
nice.
Yeah.
Listen, Lindsay, we appreciate it so much taking the time to come to Club 30.
Thanks for having me.
We needed some smart, intelligent woman here to continue to teach us. I mean, that's why we have Club 30. We have so many interesting, great people come on the show and teach us things and inspire us. So thank you for doing that.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. And I think, you know, we can all learn from each other. So I appreciate the conversation and you including me. And as a woman and fellow athlete, you know, I appreciate it. So
you're welcome back anytime.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. You know, I was really excited about this episode because Lindsay's a personal hero of mine. I love skiing. And it was all of that. You know, we stumbled on a tripwire, which was the ALS thing. And Chuppy and her mom. We covered all of the other stuff that we needed to. And I got a lot out of the conversation, but that was a special moment, I thought.
So, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was just life, you know, the challenges of being an athlete and losing close ones. I really enjoyed today. That was awesome. Growing up in RA, ski town.
Yeah.
Get this opportunity to sit down with Lindsay Vaughn. Loved it.
Loved it.
Well, thanks for listening, everyone. I hope you enjoyed it. We definitely did.
Yeah, please join us for the next episodes. We'd love to have you guys as members. So please like, subscribe, give us a rating, whatever that might be, and go on this journey with Henrik and I.
See you guys soon.